Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm your host and travel journalist, Holly Rubinstein, and today we're embarking on a journey to the east of Africa, to a country of spectacular, wild and natural landscapes, where the wildlife is abundant, the famous Big Five roaming free, a country of great plains, mountains, lush forest and white sand beaches. It's captivated adventurers and travellers the world over. It is, of course, magical Kenya. On today's episode, we'll be hearing first from some of my previous podcast guests who have chosen parts of Kenya in their travel diaries. Wildlife cameraman Gavin Thurston returns to the podcast to share his experiences, having spent so much of his career travelling around and working in Kenya. And we'll hear from one of my guests coming up on season six too. We'll be heading on a tour of the country, starting in its capital, Nairobi, and ending in Samburu National Park in the north. And it's in Samburu that my final guest, Saba Douglas Hamilton, has lived for the last 6 years. Saba is a conservationist and award-winning TV presenter. She was born and raised in Kenya, and you might recognise Saba as the presenter of the BBC's hugely successful Big Cat Diaries, The Secret Life of Elephants, and This Wild Life. She'll be joining us later to reflect on our tour of Kenya, sharing her tales of living and working in the country and her own Kenyan travel diaries. So Kenya is now on the travel green list for UK travellers. So I hope this episode inspires you to think about a bucket list experience like travelling to Kenya and experiencing all that it has to offer. We've got so much to cover, so let's get started. In Nairobi, that's where most visitors will fly into first, where journalist and TV presenter Giles Corran shares an unforgettable hotel and wildlife experience that he covered on the BBC show Amazing Hotels.
Monica and I went to Kenya for the first ever show that we did together. Yeah, and we stayed in Giraffe Manor. And I would probably say that it's like an Edwardian golf club with giraffes. It's the only place from that I filmed in that I went back with my family. And we went back to see my friend Kath. She's living on Diani Beach, which is down near Mombasa, which is a beautiful beach, sort of 10 miles long. So you've got to come and stay. But to fly to Mombasa, you can't fly direct to Mombasa unless you go with Ethiopian Airlines via Addis Ababa, which I didn't fancy. Or you can fly to Nairobi and then you fly to Mombasa. But you arrive, from what I recall, in Nairobi, you can't immediately transfer. You have to spend the night. I think the flight, there's not much time difference. The flight arrives, there's only one BA flight. You arrive about 8 p.m. and then you have to wait till morning. So I thought, well, small kids, we will go to Giraffe Manor just for 2 nights. It's just to have a stopover and then we can fly to Mombasa.
Oh, perfect.
And I took the kids in, and honestly, having filmed there, it was just a couple of days filming. Oh yeah, giraffes come into the breakfast room, they put their heads in the door and you feed them, whatever, let's just film this scene and go to bed. With my children, suddenly it was like being in the Lion King.
Really?
Suddenly it was the most exciting thing ever. So anybody with children, and then you have these amazing drawing rooms and the library and the giraffes and the lovely cooking and the incredibly nice Kenyan people, and it's a great stop off, and then you can sort of head up into Kenya.
Sounds wonderful.
Yes.
So just like Giles, we're heading east to the coast now, to the island archipelago of Lamu. With its crystal clear hidden coves, boho boutiques and sunset parties, Lamu's fast becoming a destination of choice for celebs. From Kate Moss and Mick Jagger to Madonna, Tracy Emin, even the Obamas have been there recently. It's one of Jessica Nabongo's all-time favourite destinations. So Jessica's a guest coming up on season six of the podcast, and she is the first black woman to visit every country in the world, all under the age of 35 too. She's an absolute legend, and she had a lot of destinations to choose from. So picking Lamu is a big endorsement. Let's hear from her now.
Where I love most is probably Lamu. Mm-hmm.
So what part of Kenya is that?
Lamu, it's on the coast. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on the coast. It's a small island and there's no cars on the island. There's some donkeys and you really get that like Swahili architecture and, you know, there's a strong Muslim culture. It's quiet. It's peaceful. It's just, I keep saying, I'm going to write my next book in Lamu. There's just something so peaceful and beautiful about it. And the people there are amazing. The food is absolutely delicious. I had fish samosas there for the first time in my life. I texted my mom like, oh my God, they make fish samosas here. Because my mom makes very good samosas as well.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just such an incredibly special place.
So it's an island off the coast of Kenya. So how do you get to it?
Yeah, we flew like Nairobi to Lamu.
Oh, lovely.
And then we took a boat to where we were staying.
Next, I'm so happy to be joined once again by wildlife cameraman Gavin Thurston, who won an Emmy since we last spoke for David Attenborough, A Life on Our Planet. Congratulations, Gavin. Gavin has filmed the incredible wildlife of Kenya over the past 30 years, and he shares stories of his experience all around the country, in particular Tsavo East, Kenya's biggest national park and one of its oldest over in the east, and then crossing to the southwest to maybe Kenya's most famous region, the Masai Mara, an area of preserved savanna wilderness, home to breathtaking vistas, endless plains, and of course, so much wildlife. Afterwards, we're joined by Jeffrey Kent, the founder of luxury travel company Abercrombie & Kent. Jeffrey's Kenyan himself, Kenyan born and raised, and the Masai Mara is the first destination he fell in love with. You've been to Kenya multiple times throughout your career. I mean, it's obviously a place that means a lot to you.
Absolutely. In fact, it was the first foreign shoot I ever did. I was nicknamed Photo Toto. So Toto is boy in Swahili. And I went out as kind of T-boy assistant cameraman for the first company I worked for, Oxford Scientific Films, and spent most of the time in Tsavo East National Park, you know, which is one of the larger parks. It's sort of three-quarters of the way between Nairobi and Mombasa on the coast, if you have a look on the map. And I've got very fond memories of that because that's the first time I saw elephants and giraffe and zebra and so on in the wild. And it just felt like a wild place, an exciting place to explore. And you've got all the different tree shapes and leaf shapes. It's just like, your kind of classic out of Africa imagery. So I've got very fond memories of that. And that was a nine-week shoot, and had lots of interesting encounters with different animals. In fact, in my book, I wrote about the killer bees when we got stuck in the dry riverbed in the Toyota Land Cruiser. And I've been back, I think, 30-odd times since for different film shoots, from Samburu right up in the north. In fact, I drove up on an expedition up into Sudan. So we drove right up, on those long, dry, dusty roads up through Samburu, and I'm trying to think of the names now, Turkana, right up to the border. So I have seen literally from north to south and on the coast.
Mm-hmm. And when you reflect on your time that you spent there, what place would you tell someone who is visiting Kenya that they must visit?
Top of the list, if you're going to Kenya, you have to go to the Masai Mara. It's the most magical place on the planet in terms of the number of species of animals you can see, in such a small space. You know, literally, you can be parked in your vehicle and you can scan the horizon and see maybe 12, 15 different mammal species. And there's very few places on the planet. I mean, I can't think of another place on the planet where you do that. Yeah. It is very touristy. So I think some people are shocked when they get down there at how many vehicles you might see parked around a leopard. But equally, if you're with a good driver and a good tracker, guide, they'll find places and you can spend half a day or a day without seeing another vehicle. So there's still areas you can go to where you can kind of escape the tourist throngs. Mm-hmm. But if you get your timing right, obviously go and see the wildebeest migration. Obviously they follow the rain, so they go south of the rains, because you get the fresh grass, and they'll come north again. And obviously each time they go north or south, they have to cross the river, which is when you get these massive aggregations of, I don't know, 5,000-10,000 animals all thronged together and running the gauntlet of the crocodiles in the Mara River and so on. So that is, I'd say that's top of the list, is Masai Mara.
Yeah.
And if you are going there, and this isn't a plug for a particular, there are lots of lovely small private camps you can stay in. It depends what you're after. But for me, I think probably nostalgic-wise, Governor's Camp, which is one of the oldest camps. It's right on the bend of the river. You get these lovely big safari tents to stay in. And you can be sat having breakfast, looking out and literally see the wildebeest wandering past the end of your breakfast table.
I stayed at Governor's Camp as well. When I went to Kenya, that was a place that I stayed when I went to the Masai Mara. And I remember when we were sitting out at dinner, suddenly a hippo bounding through the middle of the camp while we were just sitting there eating. There was like a bit of commotion, and then just suddenly there was just this enormous, I mean, of course, as from your experience, I mean, hippos are actually like the,
very dangerous.
The most,
yeah.
What, very, very dangerous. So I think it actually wasn't quite as kind of funny as we found it at the time. But it is one of the camps that really feels steeped in a kind of traditional history, isn't it?
Yeah, so I'd say that would be one name drop of a place to stay. And as you know, you can vouch for that. It's but all the, you know, the, I say that, I think they sleep maybe 150 or 200 people at that camp. And then there are other camps where literally it could be three or four tents. So it depends what kind of experience you're after. But Masai Mara is an area, a definite must.
Definitely.
And then the other place, which is very close to my heart, is a private area called Labour Downs, which is north of Mount Kenya. It's kind of just south of Samburu. Mm-hmm. And if you go there, there's a very small lodge called Wilderness Lodge. It's run by Will and Emma Craig. Again, some of my early memories of travelling to Kenya are staying there. And the nice thing about it being a private reserve, it's actually part of a conservancy. So animals are free to roam between the different areas. Although that it is fenced, it's a massive fence. It's 40,000 hectares or something.
Wow. Yeah.
And the main reason it's fenced to the south is because you've got all those vegetable growing areas where they're growing, you know, peas and sweet corn and stuff for Waitrose and the likes. And the animals, particularly elephants, are very tempted by that. And you get this, you know, this conflict between humans and animals, which is why it's fenced to try and reduce that conflict. But the nice thing about being a private place is there's very, very few people there. You know, you can go all day and not see another vehicle. They've got all the animals you'd want to see, you know, leopard, cheetah, lions, elephant, you name it, giraffe. But you can do it in a very kind of intimate way because you're not with throngs of other tourists. And they do these most romantic breakfasts. You're driving for like 2 or 3 hours and thinking, bloody hell, I'm getting hungry. Got it. We must be miles from the camp. And then you come around the corner and under an acacia will be a table laid out with a white tablecloth and chairs and, you know, the Maasai guys there cooking up your Samburu guides or whatever, cooking up your breakfast. It's just kind of very out of Africa imagery. So that's another top place to visit. Also going a bit further north, then you've got Samburu National Park. And if you're going there, that's the home of Save the Elephants. Abba Douglas Hamilton and Ian Douglas Hamilton and family run that. They've been running that for years, doing a lot of good work with elephant conservation. And the amazing thing going there is if you stay at their camp, which is Elephant Watch Camp, which again is this beautiful thatched, tented camp right on the river. Again, it's not, you know, they don't cater for many people. I think, you know, maybe 16 people tops. But because they know the area so well, and they've studied the elephants for so long, they know every single elephant and they know its history and they know who its mother are, you know, its father, all this kind of thing, the age of them. And also the elephants are very relaxed there and they're very used to the Elephant Watch Camp vehicles. So you'll literally have these elephants really chilled, walking within 2 feet of your vehicle. And if you haven't seen an elephant before, it is very intimidating,
but it's
an amazing experience. So Samburu and Elephant Watch Camp is another, you know, must go to place.
Samburu, in comparison to, say, the Masai Mara, I never went up to Samburu. So how does the landscape vary between the two places? Because Kenya is a very diverse landscape, isn't it? I mean,
absolutely.
People picture the Mara, but, you know, there are big rainforests and towering mountains as well.
Yeah, so if you're so the Masai Mara is mostly open plain. You've got shrubbery areas and croton thicket, which is like a, you know, scrubby bush area where the buffaloes and things will hang out. But it's mostly open with the river winding through it, and you've got riverine forest which follows the river down, and Governor's Camp is in the edge of that forest. So you've got nice variety there, but there's not many hills. It's quite low lying. But as you go further north, of course, you go up past, if you're going up to Samburu or Lewa Downs, you go past Mount Kenya on your right, which usually is pretty visible. You go up past Lake Nakuru and Lake Bogoria. Is Lake Bogoria there?
Lake Naivasha.
My geography is awful. Lake Naivasha, that's the one, which is home to the flamingos, of course. They do move, so they're not always in the same place. But yeah, so you know, you've got that mountain on your right-hand side, very imposing, with a little bit of snow on the top. But Lewa Downs, it's also got open plains, but it's a bit more rocky. You've got some you know, like little rocky, dry riverbeds and things. It's slightly drier than the Mara. And as you go up to Samburu, then one thing that becomes apparent is the landscape is dotted with termite mounds, which are an extraordinary, you know, a termite is, if you've never seen one, is about, what, 6-7 mil long, I suppose. And yet, you know, a million or so of these live in a termite mound. And they build these huge towers which stick up, you know, 2-3 meters. And in fact, as you go further north to Lake Bogoria, you know, some of those towers are like 4 meters high. It's extraordinary, all made by this tiny army of termites. So again, they're just kind of, I think this is the wonderful thing about travel is, you know, the visual feast of just seeing different things. It's stimulating to see different tree shapes or different leaves or different animals or different landscapes. And certainly Kenya has a very diverse range of that.
I think you fall in most things when you're a child, and I fell in love with the Maasai Mara. The Maasai Mara, today known as the Maasai Game Reserve, in those days there were no game reserves, there were no national parks, there's nothing. So I grew up in complete wilderness. My dad was in the King's African Rifles. We had all the army trucks and cars and camps, and he would, every holidays, he would take me off, or time when he had holidays, and I'd say to my dad, "Where are we going, Dad?" And he said, "Somewhere where you can't drink the water." I, wow, that's exciting. You can't drink the water. Nobody's been there. He said, exactly. But we will take our own water. I said, yay. And so off we went.
I love that. He instilled that adventure in you right from the very beginning.
Yeah. And so I went down the Maasai Mara. And so this is where I grew up with animals. You know, I mean, it was amazing. We lived in a lovely camp, you know, pretty rough army camp. Went shooting in the evening for guinea fowl and because we had to eat, we shot, there was nothing to eat otherwise, so we shot for the pot, you know. And so I grew up in this whole area. The game warden was a lovely guy, another fellow officer called Major Lynn Templeborough, and he was in charge of this whole area. And so that's where I grew up and fell in love with the Maasai Mara. And then, of course, when I became, just before I went to Sandhurst, now I'm a man, I went with Lynn Templeborough and shot for the first time the last time, but I shot a buffalo and elephant, but it reminded me so much of my horses, I vowed that I would never do that again. But it sort of was a passage of life, really. And then, of course, it was made into Game Reserve. Then I come back, I do the army. I come back, I start Abercrombie Kent with my mother, mum and dad. And my first place where I put one of my luxury camps, the first one in the world, think how many luxury camps there are today, but that was number one. I had it at Governor's Camp in the Maasai Mara. So, of course, the Great Migration has to be one of the most incredible sites ever. 1.5 million wildebeest, you know, 800,000 zebra, 200,000 Tommies and Grants Gazelle. What an amazing site. And so that's when I built my next camp called Kichwa-Tembo, which was near the Maasai Mara. And today I have Olanana, which is a beautiful lodge on the river. And so that was it. Then my mum and dad died. My dad died first. And I said to my mom, I'm going to bury him in the Maasai Mara. And so I bought a big lot of land. Do you remember the movie Out of Africa? And you had that amazing breakfast with Meryl Streep. And you remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's just near there. I bought the whole site actually on the edge of the Rift Valley. And that's where I buried my mom and my dad. I buried there. And I always go there when I'm there, have a cup of tea, and I can think, well, they're here, the animals all around, they're watching everything, and hopefully it'll be a long, long time before I die. I've still got, you know, many, still young, still in my teenage years, but there's a few years to come. But that's how I think anyhow. So that's where I'll be buried, and hopefully my children will be buried there. And so it's from the start of my life to the end of my life. So that's the area I really, really love.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because you talk about growing up in Kenya. The Maasai Mara is quite a contrast in a way to the Aberdares where you lived, isn't it? In the sense that the landscape and everything is, they're not that comparable, really, are they?
No, not at all. But how do you know the Aberdares? Have you been to the Aberdares or not?
I have, yes, yeah.
Yeah, you said it with such confidence. I said,
Yeah, you know I did one trip around Kenya where I went to stayed in Nairobi, the Aberdares at Aberdare Country Club. And then down to the Maasai Mara and Lake Naivasha actually, and Lake Nakuru as well. So it was a lovely trip.
So you were, I grew up, you know, we grew up at 8,900 feet, just under 9,000 feet high in the Aberdares. That's why we had frost and ice outside. And then, of course, my dad and mum always wanted to go down to warm areas when they could. And the nearest place with wilderness was the Maasai Mara. I mean, it was quite close in those days. So that's why we popped up and down the Maasai Mara between the two. And, of course, we went to the beaches too. We went down to Diani and Malindi, where I still have a home in Malindi. That's another beautiful place. The Kenya beaches are beautiful, lovely.
Finally, we head north of the equator to Samburu National Park, where influencer Lucy Williams picks her all-time favourite hotel.
Kenya, I just absolutely loved. I've stayed at this amazing place called Sasab in Samburu, which is this just amazing, sustainable, beautifully run hotel that's sort of perched up on kind of up on a riverbed. It's got incredible views, and it's just, it's luxurious, definitely, but it's not one of those African safari spots that feels very sort of, am I in Africa? You know, it feels very in touch with where it is, and it's just magic, really, really magical. And you're like, they'll make you breakfast on the back of the truck in the morning in the bush, and it's super dry and arid in that part of Kenya, but actually that kind of just adds to it somehow.
Mm-hmm. That sounds magical.
We went quad biking down the dry riverbed and then had like dinner in the tree, like by candlelight. It was just, yeah, it's
so
amazing.
Romantic.
It was very romantic. I was just with a group of friends, so it was not
and so fun.
Yeah, it was really fun. So Africa is definitely, I've definitely got the bug for going back there.
Well, what a tour of magical Kenya. And now we head back to Nairobi, where conservationist and TV presenter Saba Douglas-Hamilton joins us. Welcome to the Travel Diary, Saba. It's great to meet you.
Well, thank you. I'm hugely excited because I've been hearing all sorts of voices I recognise, and it's fun. It's almost like catching up with old friends.
Oh, that's so amazing. So of my guests, I know that you've got a special relationship with Gavin, who we heard from over at the beginning there.
That's right. Gavin and I have worked together many, many years, all over the world, mostly in the Mara doing Big Cat Diary, but also in other places as well. And he's truly one of the best wildlife cameramen that I know, and also one of my greatest friends.
That's wonderful. And he just won an Emmy, of course, which is very exciting.
I'm super proud.
So where are you joining me from today?
I'm actually in Nairobi, and where I live is borders the giraffe sanctuary. Our land actually joined up with the giraffe sanctuary 40 years ago. So we have the Rothschild giraffe coming here. We have warthogs every day that we feed. We have bushbuck. We've even had lion jumping over our gate and coming into our garden, which is quite extraordinary. And I live in a little tree house here with my kids and my husband. It's just an upstairs and a downstairs. And every evening, just after the sun sets, we have this gorgeous little bush baby that comes climbing down out of a tree, blinking at us sleepily, demanding his first banana of the night, which is how we like to share our breakfast and dinner together. So it's pretty special.
Oh, it sounds absolutely magical. And you were born in Africa, born and raised, spending most of your life, you know, living among the animals, right?
I was. I'm actually Kenyan. I was born in Kenya, and I have spent most of my life with elephants. I would say that would be the primary animal in our life, because my father is a zoologist. He was the first person to study African elephant social behavior in the wild in the 1960s. And along with my mother, and then he wrote his PhD on it. So all the fundamental things that we know about elephants now, like the fact that they are matriarchies, that was actually his primary discovery.
Absolutely incredible work. And I understand that when you were just a baby, you met your first elephant.
When I was about 6 weeks old, I believe, and there was this very special elephant who had developed a really interesting relationship with my father. Her name was Virgo. She was about 18 years old, and just this delightful, curious individual who was had some kind of interest in this human being that she kept on coming across. He was often on foot, and he was always around the elephant families. And over time, she came quite used to him and would actually come up and greet him, stretch out her trunk and sniff him. Every now and then, I think he even gave her a banana or piece of sugarcane or a gardenia fruit. Mm-hmm. But when I was born, my mother took me in her arms and she walked out on foot towards this completely wild elephant and presented me to her. And Virgo came forward and reached out her trunk and sniffed all over my body. And then she brought her own calf forward. And it was almost like this introduction between two mothers, of course, which I can't remember at all because I was only 6 weeks old. But I do always like to think that I was baptized in elephant breath.
Oh, that is just such a magical vision. How moving that must have been for your mum.
I think it was. I think it was one of those, you know, one of those unbelievable landmark moments of your life for her.
And of course, you've since dedicated a huge amount of your effort and energy and life to elephants from that moment.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, when you're brought up in a family of conservationists, you live, breathe and eat conservation and talk about it all the time. So it's very much in our DNA.
And your work with Elephant Watch Camp keeps that front and centre.
What I've done is I've actually taken over a beautiful, very special eco camp that was started by my mother, where we do elephant watching. So we're springboarding off the 25 years or so that Save the Elephants have been working in Samburu in North Kenya, where they know a population of around about 1,000 elephants that obviously come and go and are born and die over time. But we know every single one of those individuals by name, and we can trace babies that are born today. We can trace their family lineage back 4 generations. Mm. So it's wonderful, you know, not only do we know the mother, the grandmother, we also know the great grandmother. And there have been fascinating things that have been coming out from this data. We're looking at, we've seen relationships that young elephants have now with families that you wouldn't expect them to actually want to spend time with, or you wouldn't understand why they were spending a time with that animal. We've seen this specifically with orphans who of the ivory trade who have been struggling and trying to find ways to survive. And they've suddenly made a link with the family, and we couldn't figure out why that particular family. But when we look back through the data, what we found was that their grandmothers had had an amazing connection. And that little baby had probably been introduced to that family right in the early years of its life and had remembered a particular individual and had realized that that individual was important to its family and had then reached out and had had a response in return. Wow. So, you know, there's so little we know about these animals. We're still really scratching the surface.
That's incredible.
So Elephant Watch, what we do there is like whale watching, actually inspired by that idea of whale watching, is that we take people who come to Africa, generally tend to be passionate about Africa or about wildlife. Mm-hmm. And so we take them out to meet the elephants, not as great grey pachyderms, but as individuals of families that have relationships and that have navigated their way through the trials and tribulations of life. So you would go and you would meet Anastasia, who is the matriarch of the royal family. And a few years ago, you would have met Cleopatra, who is her sister, with whom she was a joint matriarch, which is unheard of. Nobody hears about joint matriarchs, but these two sisters were so aligned in their thinking that they would make decisions. They would make decisions together almost simultaneously. And as a result, their family was the biggest and the strongest and the most dominant, didn't lose any members to ivory poaching. And so you can, you know, you just meet them. It's a whole other layer of a whole other profundity, I suppose, in understanding about elephants.
Absolutely. Beyond traveling to Samburu to take, you know, the best photo you could take of an elephant, what visitors are getting to experience is actually understanding the familial dynamics, the the whole ecosystem in a kind of much more profound way.
Yes, and the larger conservation issues that are affecting them. So what we're trying to do at Elephant Watch is I find that people, you know, we're quite a raw camp. It's you're very close to nature. You're very safe. It's very comfortable and beautiful and all your needs are met. But of course, for many people who come from places like New York and are listening to sirens all night, when they come to Africa, they lie there awake all night for the first night, absolutely terrified by the sounds that they're hearing, because, you know, they can't interpret the language of wild creatures. And so what we find is it takes the first night, they survive it and they wake up the next morning, and it's almost like this skin has peeled off, and out comes this brand new butterfly that stretches out its wings and takes off into Africa. And it's the most wonderful thing to observe. I love it.
I bet.
In a way, the more alarmed people are by that first day, the more they respond to the experience. And by the end of it, by the third or the fourth day, we find that in general, people are completely converted to the cause of conservation. They understand why it's so important. And I find it a very, it's a big responsibility. You have to work very gently with people in that moment of passage from one world to the next. Mm. But now in Africa, I don't think one can come here anymore without awareness. I think you have to understand the impact of your footprint, and you have to go to places that are truly involved in conservation. I would love to see a revolution in tourism where we move away from this slightly, you'd move away from going to see the Big Five or, you know, package holidays, because you just can go there like you can go anywhere else in the world. I think anywhere that we go now, we have to think very carefully about our environmental impact. And we've got to think also what can we contribute to that place, to that experience? If we value wildlife and we value the experience of being with lions or with elephants or cheetah, how vulnerable are they? And how is us being there impacting them, either positively or negatively?
So as travellers to Kenya, what can we do when we're planning our trip to ensure that we are doing the right thing?
I think you have to do a lot of research beforehand, get online, read up about the different places you're going to, and make sure that there really is a proper program where they're employing local people. I would always advise on going to the smaller camps, because I think the smaller camps are much more embedded in each of the locations. They often tend to be more expensive, but I think the experience you get is just off the scale better than if you go to these big package areas. I know a lot of people can't afford to go to places like that, but in some ways, making Africa a once-in-a-lifetime experience, I think you maybe get more out of it than if it just is another package tour holiday.
Mm-hmm. And another thing I suppose to consider is that a lot of people would consider going to Kenya perhaps at the very famous times, like the big wildebeest migration, for example, but it's really a year-round destination. I mean, what is your favorite time of the year in Kenya? When would be another time that visitors could consider going that isn't kind of as well known in terms of travel?
I always think that the most beautiful time in Kenya is during the rains or just after the rains, and that would be April, May, June, or December, January, because everything comes alive. You know, here, we're very much at the frontier of climate change, and we're beginning to feel the extreme weather conditions quite acutely. So, for example, right now, up in Samburu in North Kenya, we have the most unbelievable drought that is devastating the area. And it has this terrible knock-on effect on the wildlife, on the people, on the livestock. And you really see how things are becoming unraveled, I suppose. So when rain comes, rain is life. And rain is the whole landscape regenerates. And everything is filled with this incredible sort of sense of joy and peace and hope. Whether and so when you know, we never talk about difficult things in Kenya until it has rained. And the, and in up in North Kenya with the Samburu, they have these wonderful blessings. So everything is again surrounded by rain. You when you meet people, and if you're trying to bless someone, you'll spit on them. And spit is a symbol of rain. And so everything is about Ngai, is about rain. Bring the rain into your life, let the milk flow, let the rivers flow, bring the grass back, and that is life. So everything that is green is a symbol of peace. And when you want to give someone a peace offering, you offer them some cut leaves or some grass, and that is a sign of peace.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I agree. And of course, you know, in Britain, you're fed up of the rain, but we're frightfully jealous of you all. We'd love to have some of your rain here.
Yeah. Oh, and thinking of the Kenyan landscape, we touched on it a bit with Gavin about how the landscape of Kenya is so diverse that what might first come to mind is, you know, the Maasai Mara and the great kind of plains. But there is such a diversity from north to south and east to west, coast, lush forest. What kind of landscape, for someone who hasn't been to Kenya, would you think would surprise them that they could discover?
Well, the Maasai Mara, I always think of it like it's like the butter on the table. You get, you know, it's just delicious and rich and fat and wonderful. As you go out into the rest of Kenya, it changes enormously. You have these incredible cedar forests up on the Mau Escarpment and up all the mountains, actually. Up in the north where we are, it's very much an arid landscape, much more of a desert, with this, you know, red iron-infused earth and the silver camphora trees and acacias everywhere, of course. And then you go towards, you know, you've got these bright green, emerald green farming areas where they do all the tea and the coffee. The coast is just beautiful. The warm Indian Ocean. I'm one of my favorite places, which I'm going to talk to you about later, is I think my secret place I want to tell you about is at the coast. Okay. But of course, there's also, I think what would surprise people is Mount Kenya, and that you can go onto places in Mount Kenya where it goes below zero at night. And you have snow up on the top of the mountain. And it actually feels like you're in Scotland. And I think what maybe would surprise people is sometimes how cold it gets, because, of course, we're up at altitude. So it can be very hot during the day. But, you know, if you sleep overnight, if you're camping in the Aberdares or you're anywhere up on Mount Kenya or even on some of the other mountain areas that you climb, or up around Nanyuki and Timau, it gets really chilly at night there. So I always recommend people bring with them a pair of jeans or, you know, nice trousers and a big thick sweater and even slippers to wear in the evenings.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Saba, there is so much that I could ask you about this beautiful, magical country. And I wanted to just get a little taste of your Kenyan travel diaries. I wondered first if perhaps we could reveal your all-time favorite Kenyan destination and why.
I suppose if you drew a line, if you go north of the equator, beyond Isiolo, up into what in the old days used to be called the northern frontier, but is now just that incredible wilderness of North Kenya that stretches from Samburu all the way up to the Ethiopian border. I think that is my favorite place. Most of it, I think the biggest part of that is the people that live there, the nomads. There are many different tribes there. You have the Samburu, you have the Rendile, the Turkana, the Gabra, the Borana, each with their own distinct language and culture and way of life. But they are some of the most extraordinary, most hardy people that I've ever come across in my life. And when you just spend time with them and talking, their stories of hardship, resilience, endurance, generosity, just blow your socks off. And I've been enormously lucky to work primarily with the Samburu people. That is my home. That is where I've been raising my children, where we've been living for the last 6 years. And it's very arid, very dry, very wild. But there's such a sense of freedom there. And you just set off and the horizons just unfold in front of you. and you sleep out under the stars, you really need nothing more than a mattress and a mosquito net. And it's an incredible place where you can walk up into tall mountains with cedar forests at the top. There's a huge elephant population there. You get many, many rare and endangered species up in the north. Very different looking from the animals that you find elsewhere in Kenya. So, you know, we have zebra, but they're Grevy zebra. We have giraffe, but they're the reticulated giraffe. Our oryx are different. Our ostriches are different. And even the lions look very different there. They're much more like Egyptian cats. And they have a completely different social structure to what you find down in places like the Maasai Mara.
Right. So it's a place to really experience a whole different collection of wildlife as well as a different landscape.
Yes. And I think one of the things that, you know, people always takes people completely by surprise when they come and stay with us at Elephant Watch is that people come there to meet the elephants, but then they fall completely in love with the Samburu. And you know, the people we work with come directly from the traditional villages. So most of them are completely uneducated in terms of literacy, but they have this entire reservoir of knowledge. I mean, they're like walking encyclopedias when it comes to the plants, the medicinal uses, the animal behavior. So we've found this amazing marriage between us coming in as scientists through Save the Elephants and then the knowledge that the Samburu bring to the table, both very interested and compatible with each other. And it's been an incredible sort of synergy, I would say, of two very different worlds that remain very different, but work very well together.
That's fantastic. And it's worth really highlighting emphatically that Kenya is now back on the green list for travel and we can go there and experience it finally again.
Which is just the best thing that's happened recently. And, you know, up in the north, it's the Kenya Tourism Board is trying to develop a northern circuit. So the southern circuit is very well known. What's not so well known is the northern circuit. And within that are very famous places like Lewa. But there are also some wonderful new little camps that are popping up all over the place that are very much linked to community tourism, like Kalepo Camp, which is up near the Matthews Range. There are new little camps being set up in the community conservancies all around Samburu. So I think in a way, I would say to people, come to Kenya, choose one place and explore it thoroughly and spend as much time as you possibly can there. And in each place, spend as much time as you can in each place and really get to know the people and the place and the animals.
Great advice. Finally, then, what about your hidden gem, a place that you know so well that maybe my listeners should head there first instead of, you know, the most famous place? Or maybe you don't want to reveal it. I know it's like your best kept secret.
Well, there's a great chunk of truth in that last statement that you made. I have to say that my all-time favorite place in the world is Kiwayu Island, which is north of the Lamu Archipelago. And there's a fantastic little desert island camp there called Mike's Camp. Kiwayu is 50 kilometers from the Somali border. So for many years, that area has been considered, well, there have been travel advisories to going there because of Al-Shabaab movements in and out between Somalia and Kenya. But I think a lot of that has calmed down recently. I think if you're willing to take the chance to go there, there is ample reward. You can fly to Lamu and then you take a boat up. You can either get in a traditional boat, which takes 6 hours to get you up there, or you can hire a speedboat and it takes you about 2 hours to get there. But what you find is this wonderful sort of series of shacks made out of coconut fiber carpets, a beach that's about 6 or 7 kilometers long, absolutely empty. The pounding Indian Ocean coming in on the one side and then a miraculous still lagoon on the other side of the island. And you have the place almost entirely to yourself. And the people that live there are called the Bajuni. And they're part of the Swahili people, but they have a lot of Somali blood in them. And they are incredible fishermen They have an amazing, I actually did my thesis, my university thesis, on their poetry, their sung poetry. They were very descriptive in their emotional sentiments. There was a lot of illicit love. And so a lot of their poetry, I looked particularly at their love poetry, was about, you know, pain and heartache. And I remember one stanza said something like, "I'm thirsty, but the well is poisoned. So do I pass and go back home, or do I drink and die?" And that was all about love.
Oh, so yeah,
it was a very special time in my life. And Kiwayu would be the place that I would recommend to any intrepid traveler who is willing to take a chance for not that much risk, but to go to one of the most special, remote, unknown desert islands along the coast of Africa.
That, what a beautiful recommendation. Thank you so much. And thank you so much, Shaba, for your time. What an incredible insight into the most beautiful country. Thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. And I'm so glad that you're so passionate about Kenya.
Oh, a huge thank you to Shaba and all my guests for bringing Kenya to life so vividly. It's really inspired me to book a trip there. You know, half the time I was meant to be working on this episode, I was just browsing safari lodges and looking at travel guides for Kenya online. My guests just really sold me so much on returning back there and connecting with nature, I think, first and foremost. That sense of space and the feeling of being so close to wildlife is just such a magical feeling. Yeah, a really magical feeling. No wonder this episode is called Magical Kenya. If you would like to read more about Kenya or get some inspiration about where you should go and what you can do there, head to magicalkenya.com or follow them on social media, or of course check out the websites of your favorite travel magazines who normally offer, you know, really comprehensive guides. I'll be back in a couple of weeks for the start of season 6 at the end of October, so stay tuned. And in the meantime, take care. Thanks so much for listening.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.